call me if I wasn't.
You need to send someone looking for him? I'm just a little concerned.
I'll shoot him a text.
I saw him Monday.
I was about to say, I'll text him.
Live and well Monday.
I feel like there would be way less questions.
Good journey. Call the question.
All right. It is 3:06. We are here for the April 17th meeting of the Duval County Election Advisory Panel. Go ahead and do roll call of the state names. Austin Quickle, Vice Chair.
Robert Maldonado, Election Advisory Panel.
Jerry Holland, Duval County Supervisor of Elections.
Robert Phillips, representing Supervisor of Elections.
Jeff Clements, Council Research.
Looks like we still have approval of the November 15th and January 17th meeting minutes, but as I don't believe there is a quorum, I have to put that off until next meeting. All right. All right, moving on to the Supervisor Election Update. To Mr. Holland.
Well, thank you. We've got 125 days to our next election and 202 days till the November election. For us, the presidential preference was a good rollout for some of the new employees, for some of the new early voting sites. We went from 19 to 24. It wasn't a big turnout. It was 19% of the Republicans, but again, that's less than a third of the overall voters, or about a third of the overall voters. So not a large turnout. We had some early voting sites literally with less than 20 votes the entire voting early voting period, you know, but it was good practice. I went by just to keep them, you know, charged up and awake. And but everything worked well. I think the only thing, we replaced a couple of EVIDs, but again, there's more than one at any location. Other than that, we didn't have any other problems or anything on the presidential preference. We're now preparing. We'll start our training for the August primary. That'll probably, the schedules will go out. Probably our start, poll workers will start scheduling sometime at the beginning of May. Really, not too much other than that. Some of the things we're working on, I'll let Robert comment on a few things also. But some of the things we're working on, in order to get the public to know of some of these new early voting sites, you know, our goal is to try to have an early voting site within about 4 miles of everybody. In some places, we don't have any sites that we can use. But in those new sites, we're going to mail out to all the voters within 4 miles of the new sites to, one, let them know that the location is there and what the hours will be in August. Hopefully to get some of that turnout. We are committed. I made the commitment to keep all 24 through the 2024 election cycle, which means don't judge one by the turnout in August and then decide not to do it in November or something like that. We give it the entire cycle to see if it's the advantage to have it there or somewhere else. But we're looking forward to see how the whole presidential cycle works out. Other than that, I thought there was a couple of things also. We did, the council just appropriated for ballot-on-demand printers. We tried in this this presidential preference to go with, in early voting, just the express vote, which is the touch screen that doesn't tabulate but fills out a ballot for the voters. But the state came and updated their poll worker procedure manual, and it requires that at every early voting site there is a ballot-on-demand printer. So the city council moved by emergency the appropriation, and so we will have two ballot-on-demand printers at every early voting site. We will still have the express votes, obviously, but if somebody really wants to fill in the oval instead of having the machine fill out a ballot for them, that will be an option for voters at early voting starting in August, and we'll continue that ongoing. So I'll let Robert, some of the other things you may think of, Robert, that we've done or changed.
We're upgrading our GIS system, a geographic information system, basically for all of recorded memory. We've been on what you call a street segment system, which means you go down a street by a certain numerical value, and one side of the road is odd, one side of the road is even. That's basically the backbone for the entire what we call the street dictionary, which determines ballot styles, which determines precincts, which determines where voters are registered. We're moving to a points-based system. Long story short, it's a benefit because, for example, right now we're at 115. Was it 115 West Wall Street?
But our address?
No, here, right here.
Oh, here. 117.
117 West Duval Street. So at the other corner, you could potentially start at 100, and then at this corner, 199. So as long as you have the segment numbers in there correct, like from 100 to 199, it's accurate. But this will allow us to actually, now instead of having a segment of 100 to 199, there'll just be like one entry for 115. And this will be beneficial because it'll prevent anyone from ever being able to register at addresses that are not there. So if you have an open segment, if you have a housing unit that says runs from 1100 to 1200, there might only be five houses, but the segment runs that long to accommodate for the numbers. And so someone could potentially put in a bad address and it not be caught. So now with this new system, there's only a valid address for every individual point in Duval County. The only issue is there's close to 900,000 addressable points in Duval County. So we have been working with a vendor to get us transitioned. We're very, very close, but not close enough to where we would switch over in the August primary. So we're going to run the two systems concurrently for the rest of this year.
And the other thing, just to kind of, it's always a topic, and you might have seen we had a press release on what we do on our roll maintenance. As many know, we work two different, we're constantly working our rolls to make sure they're as accurate as possible. And that means removing deceased voters, removing voters who no longer want to be registered, but also voters who have moved. So there's a process. One is NCOA with the national change of address that we get from the post office. With those, we start the process of, one is if the voter's address has changed, we send them a letter, which starts a 30-day process. If we don't hear back from them, then they move from an active voter to inactive status. That doesn't mean they can't vote in the next election. What it does mean is if they don't vote in the next two general elections, then they move from inactive to ineligible. So what you see, and it's evident by us working those roles, is also when we send out election mail that is non-forwardable, such as the voter information cards that we sent out last November, we also work those because normally about 10% of those will come back to us as non-forwardable, and then we start the process again of moving, you know, sending them letters. If we get an update address, they're updated, everything's good. We don't get a reply back from them, then they will move from active to inactive. One thing, just to show you the progress of that, if you look at the total number of voters that Duval County had in 2020, we had over 666,000. Today we have 644,000. And we are constantly also registering people. So that's a net of almost 22,000 less voters on the rolls. So that is about cleaning up the rolls, making sure those are active people on the rolls, and making sure that we have their current address. Again, moving from active to inactive doesn't prevent anybody, but it also means we don't know where they live, so we don't send any additional mail to them. But as soon as they vote or call us for a vote-by-mail ballot to update their address, then we'll move them back to active status. So that's sort of what's happening on ours as far as our rolls being kept clean and making sure we, our voters, are actually living here in Duval County.
Gary, what's the next step if they go from active to inactive and then they don't vote anymore?
Then they go to ineligible. Ineligible means then to vote you have to re-register. So you start the process over again. And we'll get people go to ineligible because they moved to another state, you know, register there, and then they come back to live here. Then obviously at that point they re-register again. Obviously someone can move to any of the other 66 counties in the state of Florida, and it's just a matter then they transfer their voter registration from Florida voter registration to that other county, and their record goes with them to that other county. Any questions?
When they're in inactive, I guess if they show up to the polling place, they'll still be able to vote in the inactive status, correct?
Yes, and what we typically will happen is they may show up, and if they've also updated their driver's license, they may not be at the current precinct of their address. So as the statute 101.045 says, is that you must vote in the precinct in which you live. So therefore, they may have to go to the precinct that is their correct address, and we'll send them to that location. Easier if they go to early voting, then we can update their address and give them the ballot that's proper for the precinct in which they live.
And if it's ineligible, they're just told, hey.
You're ineligible. If you come in, you're ineligible. Now, remember, at any time, a voter, if they question whether our information is correct, can always vote a provisional ballot. Then the canvassing board made up of myself, a county judge, and a council member will look at the evidence to determine whether they were ineligible. But if they are ineligible and they come in, then obviously you have to register 29 days prior in the state of Florida. They would have to register for the next election and could not participate in that election, only by provisional.
And just Daniel will not be showing up, but Linnell is on the way.
Okay.
For what it's worth.
I'll allow it.
Yeah.
Okay. Always wanted to say that.
Take the microphone up there.
Step
up.
I can talk.
Well, he's got to pick it up for the record.
With this primary being also the school board election, how are people who are non-party affiliated going to know that they can, well, number one, how will they vote for school board? And number two, how will they know that they can vote for school board?
Well, first of all, in a primary, as we have in August coming up, there is a different ballot for, because we do have partisan races that are primaries, there'll be a Republican ballot, a Democratic ballot, and a nonpartisan ballot. On that nonpartisan, which, as I tell people in a primary, there is something for everyone to vote on. Obviously, there's county judges for them to vote on, other races, as well as school board to vote on. So even state committee man for those in the parties. But we will send out a sample ballot in August to every voter. Normally, sometimes we will send it out to the household. But however, in a primary where there's three different ballot styles, there can be different people of different parties within the same household. So the way you'll know what's on the ballot, if you're a NPA, is you will receive the ballot that will have only those candidates on it for the NPA voter. You're welcome.
Could you talk a little bit about the rollout of Express Vote and how that's going? I know that's new technology for a lot of folks. So how's it been received? And I
would say overall, if you want to say 90, probably of our voters that voted even in the presidential preference, I would probably say less than 2% that we have a complaint because they didn't get to fill out an oval themselves. You know, from the standpoint of its ease to use, with the upgrades to our equipment, the DS300s and the overall voting system, the Express Votes operate faster than they used to. And so we had many, you know, obviously compliments on using it. But as I mentioned earlier, with the change in the poll worker procedure manual by the Division of Elections, we did bring back the ballot on demand printer for early voting sites for August and every election thereafter. But really, they work very well. The only thing that we found, we put a protective screen over the top so that you can't see the voters' selections from an angle. And the screen is, like many things on a computer, if it's touch, with the protective over the top, it took a little more effort. Well, what we were able to do is the screen's got an adjustment for sensitivity, and so we went back and increased that sensitivity thing, because the option was just remove the privacy screen that's over the thing if there was an issue. But by increasing the sensitivity, we did not have a problem where you had to touch multiple times in order to select your candidate after we did the testing. So very pleased with it. You know, it will be there again throughout. There is always one at every early and at every election day site as required for those with disabilities, but we will use multiple ones along with the ballot on demand on early voting sites.
Another just brief.
Sure.
Could you provide an update on poll workers and how your numbers are looking there, and just training and retention and things like that?
Well, we had a great turnout for new poll workers this time. As I mentioned in previous meetings, the state law just says that within every precinct, it cannot be made up of the same party. But the one additional doesn't have to be of another major party. By that interpretation, it can be all of one party and an MPA or a minor party. Well, I believe for transparency in the process, I wanted a minimum of two Democrats and two Republicans in every precinct. And we didn't have a problem with the Democrats. We've always had plenty of Democrats turn out to be poll workers. We had a problem prior to me coming in with recruitment of Republicans. And in fact, in the spring elections, there was six precincts that was all of one party, and there was 18 precincts that had all Democrats and one MPA. In this election in the PPP, we had a minimum of two Democrats and two Republicans in every precinct. And so it really had the turnout that I was hoping. And we did not use as many overall workers because of the turnout being as low as it was in the PPP. But we had many more that signed up that will go through the training for the primary.
I'm not, and I missed the last meeting, so I'm not sure if this was discussed. I was just looking through the minutes, and I didn't see it. But I noticed in, I guess, November when the new voter registration cards were sent around, they weren't able to be, like, punched out of the card. Is there a reason to that, or was that just like a...
What we found is, no, they're cut out by scissors.
Okay.
And some of it is cost. You know, at one time we were able to, before they were a folding over card because the state requires so much information on them, we used to laminate even the back side, which was nice because it kind of lasted longer. But really when it gets to the perforated, the expense is so much greater. And then we still had people complain because when they went to tear it out, it would tear the card. So we said, you know what, let's put the little picture of the scissors, cut them out, and then the only complaint would be is we had to cut them out. So, but at least they weren't torn up and had to replace them. But that is true. You have to cut them out with your scissors. We do use a thicker stock, you know, so it is a little thicker paper than just regular, you know, copy paper or something.
Ask about item two, additional monies for, what did they approve, city council?
Yeah, they just approved, it was just close to $200,000 for the ballot-on-demand printers. And we'll have two in every early voting site. And that carries not just the printers, but also the toner and paper that we need through the November election. The lawsuit?
We talked about that.
Yeah, that's pretty much on the precincts, how we got from 186 to 160. was a lawsuit on under the Equal Protection Clause that we had 14 council districts. Some was many as 19 precincts and some as few as 9. So we came up with a median of 11 and with no more than one or less than one from that median. And we did meet that, obviously, for the lawsuit and in the presidential preference. That's we used all 160 of those.
Okay, as far as legislation, I'm only aware of one bill that got through. That would be HB 135. Are there any others?
Call anything else? Okay.
I don't think there is any.
Do you know what was in that bill?
That was the bill that when you went to the MVA or DMV, a lot of DMVs were just changing or just making you an NPA instead of a Republican or even a Democrat who's got to be an NPA. And they didn't ask and they didn't. I mean, that may or may not have happened here, I don't know, but it was an issue in other counties, so that's the main thing that got...
It was interesting. The tax collector, I went to a place that he spoke at Monday, and I asked him, I said, are you aware of that? And he said, no, he wasn't even aware of the bill. And of course, our tax collector handles all the drivers, motor voters, and driver's license. He said, well, we don't ask for party, and so... I have not recently looked at when you go to do motor voter, if they turn the screen and you pick it or they select it. And so I don't know that. We may want to invite the tax collector to come to one of our meetings here and explain their process, you know, to see that. But I do remember the bill. That's why I asked him about it. But he didn't know of any procedure they were doing differently at this point.
I don't think it was an issue here. I did a lot of the voter registration right outside the DMV in Atlantic Beach, and for the most part, they asked what party you wanted. Yeah.
I know, you know, like when we do naturalization ceremonies, the school registration drives, we always check to make sure they've checked a box. But it is true, if you do not check any boxes on a voter registration application, it is not one of the 7 required that to be able to register. It will default to NPA. You know, if nothing is selected, you do default to NPA.
My question is, are they even asking these people if they want to register? Or also, if they're asking, are they asking for proof of citizenship at that point?
Right. Again, that would be a question for the tax collector. But on the citizenship, from my knowledge, and it's the same thing in our office and theirs, to put it bluntly, it is an honor system. By that I mean is my role is ministerial in that if you check the box that you're a U.S. citizen, it is processed as you checked it. If you check the box that you have not committed a felony or had your rights restored, it is processed as that. Or if you check the box that you're not mentally incapacitated, it's processed accordingly. The State Division of Elections, now that's different. They're the required entity to do the research and confirm, are they U.S. citizens? Do they have an outstanding felony, you know, that hasn't had the restitution or time served? You know, that's the State Division of Elections, but not either the tax collector nor at their DMV or the Supervisor of Elections can ask any of those questions, like show me proof that you're a U.S. citizen.
So in his December 7th address to one of the subcommittees in the state legislature, our Secretary of State said that there was no way he could do anything about that.
Well, it's...
I don't want to say that was his quote, but in essence, that is what he said. The meeting back in December, yeah.
Right. It's totally in their camp to do that. I mean, whether they accomplish it or not, it is totally theirs.
Isn't it our responsibility to make sure that that we are not getting illegal aliens voting and making sure that they make sure that that is occurring? And how can we affect that? What can we do?
from a standpoint of, again, the Office of Supervisor of Elections on a county level can't do anything to verify that. The thing the state added about a couple years ago, they do put the responsibility on the voter that if you look at your voter information card now on the back, what it paraphrases says, though you received a voter information card, this does not necessarily say that you're eligible. You must know whether or not you're eligible. And that was the issue when they were prosecuting some people who had not had their rights restored but had received a voter information card. And they said, well, they gave me a card. I assumed I was eligible. So that goes back to, again, the process of even though the state may not have verified citizenship, felon status, mental status, any of those statuses, they can come back at any time. And when they find out, and then move forward on prosecution because it's up to the voter to know whether or not they're eligible to vote.
Okay. I understand that we as a county have no power over this. However, as a citizen, I want to find out what I can do to help this situation. It's said that there's over a million illegal aliens on the voter rolls right this minute in Florida. So, you know, it's going to be hard to get them off, obviously. And also, we need to stop them from adding more. And, of course, that is the agenda. So what can we tell Secretary of State Cord Byrd?
I don't think I can give you a dialogue that will give you the exact result you want, but I think it's a conversation you've got to have with the Secretary. And I think it's a conversation you can have with both your state representatives and state senators. They, again, empower the Division of Elections through through the statutes in which they pass and then the governor signs. But at this point, we're just, again, we want the same thing you want. You know, as I was mentioned earlier before y'all got in, our constant job, especially when elections aren't going on, other than training the poll workers and registering people, is to make sure our rolls are clean. A good evidence of that, as I gave numbers, is that January of 2021, after the presidential election, there was 666,000 voters in Duval County. Today, there is 644,000 voters in Duval County, almost 22,000 voters less. And we're registering constantly. That net less is a part of cleaning up the rolls, is removing people as we get information from the state, from vital statistics, from return mail, moving through the status of active to inactive to ineligible, again, is about ours is trying to keep it, you know, exactly what it should be, but with the information we get. The easiest thing that we correct the rolls with is two things, vital statistics, those deceased voters, and also, again, return mail. As we get where voters are no longer, we don't know where they live, and they start that process of going from active to inactive. Those are the two major ways that we see voters move off the voter rolls.
Is there a way to get monthly totals of new voter registration applications? Is that public knowledge, public information?
Well, you could request. Now, some of the applications are not paper applications because, again, they're registering through Motor Voter. They're registering, you know, online. So when you're requesting the paper application, if that are just a list of who registered that month.
Yeah, who registered, who actually got on the voter roll that month.
We would be able to provide that. That's you know,
public information.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, on the report every month is the district demographics, and you can see the changes, you know, where we've what it was from the previous month. Of course, that will take an effect those removed as well as those added. But just send me an email what you're looking for, and I'll see what report we can generate, you know, that's out there. But all that's, you know, the actual applications, there are certain things obviously that are protected on it. The signature itself can't be copied, as well as driver's license or social number.
Ms. Martinez's concerns has the issue of
Well, the difficulty is determining, you know, again, there's no way of knowing who is documented or not documented when the elections office is, is just taking the application. So, you know, the only kind of information would be if there were people that were found, you know, not to be eligible and then prosecuted. I can say that I haven't seen, but that doesn't say that it is not happening. But again, you know, there are certain things, for example, illegal or undocumented person can get a driver's license in the state of Florida, but it does so note that on the driver's license. So again, you've got to realize to register, they must provide one of two things, a driver's license number or the last four digits of the social. That's what's really trying. If those don't match, if it doesn't come back with a person with that driver's license, and that driver's license would be, again, that would identify whether they were a U.S. citizen or not, because they do that during that processing, or that social would also identify if they were not a U.S. citizen.
You don't need both.
No, one or the other. You know, you can. I have people who put both in there, but one or the other. So again, that's, to go back to your question, Robert, is that's the information that's trying to generate the accuracy to the rolls.
If I may, I have a comment, and then I actually do have a question. I do apologize to the panel and to the Supervisor of Elections for my lateness.
That microphone, please.
Do I need to repeat that, or are we okay? I still don't have a light. All right, so again, my apologies. So the governor and the secretary of state does have available to them the Office of Election Crimes and Security, and he utilized that particular facet to arrest 19 of our fellow Floridians who had voted and were not able to cast a vote in the state of Florida because they hadn't cleared all their fines and fees. So I do want to put that out there. He does have something available to him. And I'm familiar with the comment that he made about the federal government. I'm talking about the Secretary of State at the December 7th meeting. But there is nothing that actually says officially or in fact that there are a million persons who are casting votes in the state of Florida who are not registered voters, not legal voters. And I say that because I know members of the public are sitting here and we say things and people will take that as the gospel. I do have faith that Secretary of State Cord Byrd, if he thought that there were a million people who were illegally voting in the state of Florida, would use everything that he had available in his arsenal to prevent that from happening and to get retribution or accountability. So I do have faith in him for that. So if you said this at the beginning and I missed it, I do apologize. I just wanted to know if there was any pushback from the public about the express votes during early voting, because you blanketed the whole all early voting sites with it. And I do know in the past people had some hesitance about using it. So did you get any negative pushback at all, or was it really a good training opportunity for us?
Both. It was a good training opportunity. I think it went well. But, yes, there were voters who wanted to fill out the ovals, and no doubt. Percentage-wise, I'd say definitely less than 5%, probably closer to 2 or 3%. And mind you, this was a Republican-only election, you know, so it's a sample of only one of the parties. But the change to go back to ballot-on-demand printers weren't because of the number of responses. It was because they changed the poll worker procedure manual, which required it, you know. But I've always voted with the express vote, you know. So again, most people, majority, didn't have a problem, but we did have some.
Okay, I have a comment about her comment. Okay, so there's an article just yesterday about how in his testimony in the, I guess it's the House, our DHS person who was indicted, his name is escaping. Head of DHS,
right,
said that elections are not his problem, and he is not responsible for identifying illegal aliens, and that's not his problem. Elections are not his purview. So my question to you is, I have complete faith in Cord Bird also. He's a good friend, and I like the man very much, but there's only so much he can do given the law and how things stand. And that's what, you know, I'm really trying to find out. What is it that he can do? What is it that he is allowed to do? Where is the information coming from? How reliable is this information coming from DHS and wherever else it comes from? And it's, my questions are informational. I don't know.
And I don't either, because that's kind of residual in a sense that, you know, it's a product of we get from the state and Division of Elections. Their due diligence, we don't know to what degree. I do know they have a 100% commitment to try to make sure the rolls are correct. You know, we hear that at every conference and when the secretary speaks, and we do a monthly call in where the secretary and director of the division addresses all the supervisor of elections within the state. So there's no doubt it's a concern. But again, it's one of those things that once it leaves our hands and goes to the state, it's their responsibility, and we'll take it accordingly.
That it's an honor system, and perhaps it shouldn't be.
Well, that would go back to your legislators. They could require any level of...
Can you do that as a state? I don't think you can in a federal election.
Well, from a standpoint of identifying yourself, there's certain things that are state laws in elections, and how, you know, they're not conducted the same way in every state. You could get the same way where you get pulled back from some who don't want IDs, you know, who believes that limits the voter who doesn't have an ID. You can have various degrees of how you're protecting the vote. Again, the question comes back the way that state of Florida circumvented the requirement, you know, where some states said, well, you can't require someone to have an ID, is even in the state of Florida, if you go to vote and don't have an ID, it doesn't prevent you from voting. You will vote provisional and will match the signature to the signature on file. Again, that's why IDs are allowed, but in some states they still have no ID requirement. So, again, it would have to be tested. You know, can you require, you know, proof of citizenship? Can you do that? That's, again, above my pay grade. So,
anything else on that topic? All right. No, go. Yeah, all right.
You mentioned the certain early voting sites, or maybe not even early voting. Certain sites had less than 20 votes at some sites. Was that just a product of the smaller election?
Well, it's... No, it's more was a product of this being a Republican only, and the demographics of our city being in some precincts you have a 85-90% other than Republican, and so a very low turnout and low numbers were related to in those particular areas of just not having a lot of voters who were eligible to vote in the March 19th election.
I will tell you a number of voters that we spoke to as they came in. You know, we always say, please go home and tell your friends, family, anybody else, register Republican. This is their day. And a number of folks who gave comment and said the local party had endorsed a candidate, and so they really didn't feel like there was going to be any competition. And we said, well, you know, every vote matters. So I'm not sure if that contributed in other areas as well.
I think it contributed probably to the overall turnout. If we were at the point in the entire selection, in the same way where the Democrats with the incumbent president was the presumptive nominee, if you had contested in both and they weren't decided by the time Florida had its presidential, yeah, I think you would have seen both. Obviously, a note would be the number of advertisements, you know, political advertisements to get you out there. But being when it got to Florida on both sides, it was pretty much decided from the standpoint. And even, I think, by Florida, I think the number of delegates needed for the convention was already met by both candidates. So from that standpoint. But fortunately, in all counties, and our county being one, We have voters, and they will be there no matter if it's decided or not, and I love those voters. So.
Anything else? Before we move on, I think old business, or is that where we're at this point? We got the resolution, the congressional district, and then there's really nothing else for the Florida legislature election-related legislation other than, I think, what we talked about, HB 135. Before moving on to old business, we're approaching, I know the general election's coming up. What kind of things are we preparing for, like voter outreach-wise? I mean, is there anything on tap? Jaguars, I know OTAs are going to be starting in a couple months. Anything, jumbo shrimp?
You know, one thing is you always try to figure out what drives your voters to vote. And over the period of time that I've seen that, you know, we've done everything from billboards to signs on the street lamps downtown to mailings to everything. What typically drives the voters the most is the candidates. The desire to support or not support a candidate, to vote. Ours is to make sure we have accessible locations and the voters are knowledgeable of that. You know, I do as many interviews as possible, let people know what they need to know when they come to the polls, how to find out their polling location. Again, we'll send out sample ballots prior to every election to every voter in August, and it may be just household in November because obviously everybody gets the same ballot in their precinct. But there's no specific. In the past, the office has done some outreach at shrimp games and the Sharks and the Jaguars and stuff like that. I'm not convinced that does anything to move the needle. You know, a person in the office who used to handle that, I said, can you measure that? You know, because I want to be able to measure a result of any kind of promotion. You know, I want to see the needle move, you know. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, we're going to send out cards to everybody within a new location. That's to let them know there's a new location and when the election dates are, you know, for a new early voting site. And then again, you know, those are the kind of things we will do some. I'm working with the surrounding counties to do a joint advertising it's more for November than August, but for November so that the four counties will come together and, again, promote early voting. The other part of our promotion is to move the needle on when people vote. You know, again, to take the pressure off Election Day, we want as many people to vote prior to Election Day. All supervisors do. Because, again, if right now everybody went to Election Day, we'd have some long lines. And our desire is people not to have long lines. But with the number of locations we have and the reduction of locations, we will be promoting vote early. If they want to vote by mail, vote by mail. You know, but that will be more of our push, is to get them to vote prior to Election Day. You know, so, but we think to actually get someone off the couch is the candidates who moves them off the couch. So,
it's safe to say that many people will be motivated 2.0 from 2020. So,
and you know, and the other, we've talked about this in the office. A lot of times when we look and measure elections, we look at turnout. We'll say, well, you know, for example, we had 19% of the Republicans vote in March. We'll probably have somewhere between a turnout of 25 and 29% in August, overall turnout. You know, 75-76% in November. But where that number moves the most is really how accurate our rolls are. Because, again, if you've got people in the rolls who are no longer voting here because they don't live here, it only lowers your percentage. You're counting in your numbers people who aren't even intending to vote because they're not here. So part that we're trying to move the needle is to make sure that we're measuring the people who are actually eligible to vote in Duval County and haven't moved. So,
Of course.
Do you mind if I ask, based on the numbers that you just gave or your percentages, do you mind if I ask why the four counties are coming together for the big push in November, when November will automatically already have a larger number of voter turnout than to drive people out for August?
Yeah, because my point was it wasn't to get the turnout. It was to get the move to vote prior to Election Day.
Okay.
That, because what happens, And the reason that can affect turnout is if people wait to election day and they go, there's a line, there is a potential that I'm not going to wait in line. So you can actually affect the turnout by getting them to vote prior to election day by creating less of lines and problems on election day. So what we're trying to do is use the money, you know, to solve problems and try to help the election process. And in a way, it can help the turnout, but not by the means of which it means is go vote because it's your duty, your right, and all those kind of things. Typically, we don't move the needle with that message. You know, it's the right message. It just doesn't move the needle. The candidates move that needle. But we can move the needle by, if we don't do a good job and we have long lines and people go, and I got to get to work, I can't vote, you know. And those are the kind of things we have an impact on.
Do you have any idea what the dollar to vote ratio is when you hold an election? Obviously, the presidential primary was very unique because it was one party. But as a taxpayer and as a precinct manager, I do often wonder, what did that election just cost us? We had this many voters, and we had that much money. No matter who's on the ballot or what's on the ballot, you staff every precinct and have everything ready. So I'm just curious as to what each vote cost us when we have such poor turnout.
One of the days that we were at the early voting site, we figured how much money they were paying each of us to be there and how many votes we got, and it was $157 per vote.
Overall, in the whole process, and that election was probably close to $25 a vote when you take the total number. You know, now it is more expensive when you break down, say, early voting, and there wasn't much, because again, you may be, you know, the least expensive way to vote is by mail. You know, doesn't the personnel that takes to conduct that and that, but and early voting is very expensive if you don't have a high turnout. You know, so, but I just did some rough numbers there, about $25. What you would normally see in a presidential is that dropping all the way down to $4 or $5 a vote, you know. I think we're averaging now, it's still over $1 million to conduct an election countywide.
Absolutely.
You know. And early voting is about, per site, we were looking the other day, close to 40,000 per site,
yeah.
You know. So, and our precincts aren't that expensive. Almost all of them are not. There's occasionally one where you got to have it, but run you somewhere, you know, just, you know, the labor and everything, you're probably talking maybe 4,000, you know, that what you got going in. But also part of that cost that goes into that is, again, we have a call center. You know, I don't have a call center today, but I have one during elections. We hire additional people in the warehouse and the IT staff and all that to get in there. And sometimes we can adjust staffing knowing it's going to be. We knew March was going to be low because we eliminated, you know, almost 2/3 of the voters who weren't being eligible. But we still have to prepare. You know, someone said, well, you know, you know in August the turnout will be less than 30%. Why do you print 75% of the ballots? Because I can't guarantee, I can't get to the point where I printed 40% and I got a precinct that had a high turnout and say, sorry, we don't have any more ballots, you know. So you've got to prepare for the worst case scenarios, you know, and to do that costs you a lot of money. The thing I loved about Express Vote is I can use those over and over again, those ballots. You know, and I can use the ballot on demand paper, but when I print ballots at the precinct, we have to destroy literally thousands of blank ballots at the end of the election, you know. Good questions.
What did you say an early voting site costs?
About 40,000. It depends on the number of days. You know, you can operate a minimum of 8 days and a minimum of 8 hours. Like in November, we will go the full 2 weeks, 12-hour days. We will cut back, I think, the hours in August. But, again, we try to adjust that based on, again, what we think the turnout is to a certain degree.
Just real briefly, I know it's only been a few months, but
Well, I tell you, I get constant, you know, from a standpoint of Jerry's world and what I'd like to see, the light keeps getting dimmer, you know. But from a standpoint, we looked at the state building, the I was trying to think, is it Fuller Warren building. It wouldn't be big enough to move both the downtown office and the election center, but possibly the election center, and it's a block away. We just walked that yesterday and looked at that. We look at any site, but the reality is it's tough. Our operation doesn't – I've been sent to everything from the old Blue Cross building to the JEA building. It's not a typical office environment. By that I mean we have a mailing machine about size of this room here. You can't get to a second or third floor, you know, in a standard elevator with it, you know, so it has to be on the first floor. Well, the other consideration is that machine and the counters for those ballots is next to our canvassing room, which is a training room. So now that needs to be on the first floor. Well, along the first floor, you want all your equipment to be on the first floor. So you've got certain things that are happening that lends itself. You could have a two-story building, but when you start getting three and more stories, you're spending more time going up and down the elevators and trying to get things out, you know, the equipment out. So we have a very, for those who toured, we have a very nice facility at Imeson. It lays out well. But it also, we started with a blank warehouse and designed that. You just don't, when I walked in the Fuller Warren building, I said, well, the first step would be the entire gut of the building, every wall out except for the standing columns in the building and the restrooms, and start from there and try to figure out our office. And it still makes it difficult. So, but to answer your question, no new news, except we are renovating our downtown office because it was kind of deplorable, and because I think we're going to be there for a while.
The conversation about UNF having a polling site, whether it's election day or early voting, goes round and round in the community, so I just pose it to you.
Sure, as an update.
Is that something that you foresee coming back?
I'm actually meeting with the staff Friday from UNF that really wants an early voting site. The problem there is, I've expanded, but what I set as a criteria on my early voting sites is first to try to get one within 4 miles of every voter. UNF actually has two sites within 4 miles, and another site almost that close. So from a standpoint, it's like, sure, for the students it's more advantageous, as it would be if I put one in City Hall for the employees here at City Hall. And you can't deny that it wouldn't be easier for those employees. But at some point, what you're doing is, if you put it where you have sites that close, then you're taking money that if you can expand further out where you don't have a site within 4 miles, those voters are losing the advantage that others have. It walks yourself into potential, and I look at that from the lawsuit of the precincts, is you want to make sure, one, is the population has equal access. If you notice with our 24 sites, if you know our population in Duval County, it almost splits with the river. Almost half is on one side of the river and half is on the other. If you count our early voting sites, half are on one side of the river and half on the other. That's not by accident. That's intentional, because you want to equal your access. So at the point, I don't think I could justify at this point an early voting site there. And we're talking about Election Day, an early voting site there, until I've reached, I think there's going to be a new library out at on the north side. That will take voters who are not in the 4 mile into that. We also, and Chairman, Ray mentioned, Pringle mentioned, is one out at the Dinsmore Community Center. And actually one there that is an Election Day location would actually take our 4 mile radius out to part of the county that isn't within 4 miles. So, I mean, in my goal back again to get as many people vote prior to Election Day, Ultimately, I'd love to have 30 early voting sites. That's Jerry's perfect world. But again, I don't think it's going to meet the criteria until I met more of the county getting within 4 miles of early voting. Now let's go back to Election Day.
I do have one question about that.
Okay.
Do you foresee, if not being able to provide early voting, you also mentioned vote by mail, way to get everybody to vote early and not on Election Day. Do you foresee your outreach folks, your education staff, working with the college to create some sort of vote by mail campaign to really...
That's a very good idea. That's a very good idea, especially those who live on campus and stuff are within that area. As I meet with them this week, I'll also talk to them about that. Our goal, again, is we want to see, in our mind, you know, people on both sides of aisles and different things want to see increased turnout within their camps. Mine is about increase the turnout for the entire county. So if I can get a boost out of them, you know, voting one way versus another, that would be exciting to do. So,
and then Election Day,
actually, what I'm trying to think, the location that's where they go now
would probably be.
If you lived on the campus, that precinct is actually the church there on Kernan.
Yeah, Chet's Creek.
Chet's Creek, which again, what you have to look out from the standpoint is, you wouldn't take the people. UNF is. And I'm graduate, undergraduate, and graduate there. And so if you're not going there to class and you're just coming in, you know, it's not anywhere within that core around the loop. Good luck, you know. The only place is out there at their, trying to think of what it's called. It's the
Herbert Center.
Herbert Center is the only place that's practical. Or then the next place is to the Alumni Center that's out there on Kernan, you know. So, you know, from that standpoint, that is more practical for because you're not going to just, unless you create a precinct. The other thing I need to check is that's in City Council District.
They're actually in 11, so that's what I'm looking for. Right?
The campus is actually in 3. No, because... Will Lanen picked up UNF. And so, and I think on Kernan. So
yeah,
the
church is on Hodges, not Kernan.
Hang on, I'm looking it up.
Yes, it's the one on Hodges. And let's see, you come in off of. No, but it's not Chet's Creek Church. It is the church on Kernan, but it's not Chet's Creek. That is on Hodges. So, but Linnell, that's, you know, I think all those, you got to do whatever you can to promote that. I've got to make sure that district isn't a 12, goes back to that number, no more than one from there. And I can't make it easier for one, but make it a lot harder because most of the people voting are outside of the campus. But looking at those numbers, we can look at that. So. Student voting, from a standpoint like any other voter.
They're claiming their address is here at UNF.
Oh, well, they have the option. A student can. A student can, one, keep their parents, their home address, you know, because it's not, the campus isn't, have to be considered as a permanent address because they come home in the summer and all those kind of things. Or they have the option also of moving their address to the campus. You know, there's no residency requirement in Florida that you got to live somewhere so long before you vote. You know, years ago, if you moved into a state, you had to be there so many days before you can do that. So if they're on campus, they can vote there. And then let's say they voted in the spring elections and they go home in the summer, and let's say they're not going to take fall. They could switch their thing back to their home. You know, so it can be their home address. I see some students that leave it, you know, in the county in which their parents live and still leave their address there. So, and vote by mail.
To Tennessee or wherever.
Well, they can do that also. If they're an out of state, they can still keep their residency in another state and come here. Now, what happens is they can't get in-state tuition,
yeah, if you,
you know.
If you register that you live at UNF, you
after the first year, if you're an out-of-state student, there's a requirement there that keeps someone from, once you move in, you can't get in-state the day you move in. So
it's Kernan Boulevard Baptist.
Yes, and it is in 3.
Yeah, 309.
Yeah. So and do you know how many precincts is there? See what the highest
in
number
District
is.
In District
3. 12.
Yeah.
That was the other thing. Yeah. Sometimes you get so close to thinking, oh, that'll work, and then there's that one more key to the or piece of the puzzle.
Plus what we found previously when we did what you talked about with a vote by mail, I mean, encouragement, it's such a commuter school. They already live in a precinct somewhere else, so it's not beneficial for them to vote by mail when they still live in Duval County. And the ones that do vote by mail are registered in another state, so they can't use our vote by mail. We have to just put them in touch with whoever their home county is.
You know, I would love to see, and I'll talk to the UNF people, to see if they can come up with a number, you know, of how many people. And we can probably cross-reference registrations to addresses and see how many people we're talking. Because, again, knowing it, having been a student at UNF, there is a lot of, you know, people that live outside the campus that go to the campus, you know.
If I'm not mistaken, today is the date that the, and if you talked about this earlier, I apologize, let me know and I'll read the minutes later. The new vote by mail online form is available for the state of Florida. I think today is the day. But my understanding is it doesn't change your local vote by mail request form here locally. Is that correct?
We just had a call from the state. Also, the voter registration application changes too. And that is a little more critical because after a given date, we cannot accept any voter registration applications with the old revision date on it. And so we have to be real careful there as we go out or say a third-party voter registration group has apps and do that. But
they're out at the libraries.
Yeah, we have to pick all those up, everything, you know, because at last we want to do is do a drive and then notify the people that that application didn't count. So, but I'll have to verify that. I know we have certain things we do change on that, but I don't have all the details yet, so. Well, you filling out the paper one is the best way. Now, mind you, I assume the person that was advising you and wanting to get it back within 14 days was a third-party voter registration organization, because otherwise you could take an application to them, but unless you're part of a 3PPVRO, then you can't take that application. You can't be in possession of it. Yeah, you can.
No, this was just a person that was asking me because
I know but you can. The point is, you could give them the application to fill out. You can give them an envelope with a stamp on it and say mail it in, but they just have to mail it in to us. I mean, that's, you know, okay, if so they'll fill one out.
It has to be a third party, like the Republican or Democrat parties.
There's several in town that are third party. They can go out and take possession. You fill it out, you give it to me, they'll bring it into the office. They can do that. You, even as an individual, can say, here's a registration application, fill it out, here's an envelope and a stamp on it, you mail it, you don't take possession, you can do that, you know.
Are those numbers, those applications, how do you know the one that I took, you know, I took it and I gave it to them and they forgot to mail it in, am I responsible for it?
Well, what happens is a couple things. that person, when they do the application, probably dated it. Should have. That's one of the requirements down on that last line, signature and date. When it comes back in and the date is older than 14 days, it means it was held on. That's the first determination that the application was kept longer than the period of time you were given. Now, the fine really gets fine. You hold on to it until after book closing. You know, now the person's not eligible to vote in that next election. Those are where it becomes very punitive, you know, but that's how typically the date lateness of it is by the date on the application. Shame, she ought to, you know.
But also, are there a lot of third party? There was a lot of third party registrations that were a problem in the past, and there was the new law passed a year ago about not allowing that. Have there been a lot less?
Yeah, there were some groups that decided not to be. Now, League of Women Voters, y'all still third party or?
Yes, sir, on the record. We are not using that status. We do not do voter registration under 3PVRO.
Okay.
We do provide people with voter registration forms, an envelope, your address, as well as a stamp.
Yeah,
so that they
which is totally legal.
We do not take possession of any pieces of
where y'all used to be one.
Yes, sir. And we still have that number on file should we decide to move in that direction again, but at this time, we are not.
Yeah. So there were definitely groups that decided, fine can get pretty darn stiff. I think up to $250,000
is a lot of dollars.
Yeah, so.
And we were doing good business, but we didn't have that kind of money to give away.
Yeah.
All right. Any old business needs to be taken care of that was not addressed? I don't see anything. No? All right. New business, the EAP annual report.
I started working on that today. I will... What I do is each year I go back through the minutes of the previous year since you submitted your last report and just basically make a list of the topics that you all discussed. If you had any guest speakers, I would make note of them. And I will bring that, well, I'll send it out to you when I send out the meeting notice for the June meeting so that you all can look it over. If you think I missed anything, that needs to be in there, let me know, and I can put it in, and you all can vote on it at your June meeting, and I'll get it submitted for you.
I guess while we're on that point, are there any funding areas that we could include in our report of you know, obviously a new operations center, but, you know.
Yeah.
Part of our role is to make recommendations on, you know.
Right. At this time, I don't think there's any. The only other thing we're looking at, and that's also another requirement in the poll worker manual, is it's an interpretation of whether or not you have to or have them available, is when a person checks in at early voting, that if they are using a Florida driver's license, that you have the wanding system in order to first check their in by way of wand. You know, and we have not been, the office has not used those in a while, but they've added that to the poll worker manual. So we will be probably seeking funding for that, you know, for the wands to do the check-in of voters in early voting. You know, question is whether we will, see, we're right now on the point of, you know, that's why the ballot on demand was like almost the last thing before you can implement before August. And then otherwise we'll be putting it in next year's budget, which starts October 1. So I don't think we're looking at any kind of emergency funding. You know, we do have some funds on hand for certain things that we got through grant money. And so we'll be using those for other, you know, improvements. Good question. I don't know when the next meeting here.
June 26th.
We still have the bill where they're giving us back the funds from that grant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there was a reimbursement to the elections office for security money spent on security items. It was about $237,000, I believe it was, And what we asked the administration was, in fact, we're having an assessment tomorrow by Homeland Security. We've already done the state's security assessment. This is Homeland Security coming in. And so we asked that the money that was reimbursed for other security things, if you could put that back in our office to use, because we're getting another security assessment. And that goes through finance next cycle. And then the council. So that is an appropriation coming up that we've got the blessings from the administration and council members to get that money back to spend on security and building enhancements. So, but just, you know, Carmen, you mentioned, and when it comes to motor voter, I would love to see just an invite to the, you know, Mr. Overton, to tax collector, to get, you know, some of their firsthand information on how they do that. But none of it, he never mentioned one thing at all on voter. I'm talking specific, not to come and tell us what they're doing with tags and license, but voter registration. So, if I mean, you had a good question. I thought he might be able to answer it.
I just think it's egregious that all they have to do is check a box, and that's like, that's not, that makes no sense at all, okay?
I don't write the rules, I follow them. Yeah.
All right, nothing else. We'll open up public comments.
Yep. Sure.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ernest Smith, and I'm representing myself. My address is 6240 Pettiford Drive. I live in 09 area and not far from the Brentwood area. I know there was a lot of discussion around a liquor store in the Brentwood area, and at this last Jack's Partnership luncheon, the mayor stated that the city purchased that area, that property, and the purpose was to add a business center. Now the city currently owns that property, and that property sits in an area of town that has been economically distressed, left behind. We know that. And the reason I bring that up is possibly, if we can get on the record, we can use that property, since it is city-owned, to convert it into an early voting site, given that area has a high percentage of low socioeconomic individuals who possibly can't drive, you know, to the nearest early voting site, which would be, I believe, Bradham Brook. On Edgewood, or Legend Center on Soutelle. And I believe those are within the 4-mile radius. However, you have to understand, voter turnout in this area is low due to a lack of early voting sites where you can easily walk to or be transported to. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Again, it's something to think about, possibly to bring out more votes in that area. So, again, my name is Ernest Smith. If you have any questions or concerns, I'm here for you.
And through the chair, if I can respond, we actually went out and looked at the location, you know, because we're always looking for locations. We were surprised at how limited the parking was there. There was only like 6 parking spots, and I was surprised even for the liquor store that it only had so few parking spots, you know. But that was one of the limitations. The other part is, even for this cycle, is it's not – currently the inside set up where we could use it. I'm not ruling it out, you know, as a potential of one of the other ones, you know, doesn't, but it was very interesting. I literally sent out our person this week to take a look at it, you know.
And with regards to the parking, I know that there is a school, KIPP school. It is a private school. It's private property. However, if the city could work with that school to possibly provide parking, again, because that I think would be a great walk-up site.
Is it on this? Now, that I'm not as familiar.
It's on the same side.
On the same side.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's something that's a potential there. But, again, it goes back to kind of like the UNF. As I expand more and look, and then I'm also wanting the best site, meaning like we were in Joseph E. Lee at one time, and that it was a very small, limited parking, so that's why we left that as an early voting site. So, again, if this even meets the criteria of a better site than somewhere else, you know, that. And I'm also looking for long term, which means not just to fill a gap for this election, but like if the city then pulls it into a business center, then I lose it. So, but let you know that we are evaluating and actually went out there this week. So I'll take your comments and consider them as we look at everything.
Thank you.
Next meeting, June 26, 2024. Oh, yeah.
I have one quick question. Have we got any applications? I do believe we have a mayor's seat on this panel as well as the city council.
She's sitting here.
There, not
like
here.
Like to introduce Gloria? Yourself?
Yeah, I'm Gloria Einstein, and I've been nominated to this group, but there's been some confusion about the rules committee, so I'm not officially on it. But I hope to join you in June.
You have our blessings.
And that was the mayor's seat?
I guess it was because...
Yes.
So we still have one for the city council president?
Or no?
No, I think we just have the one vacancy.
All right.
Because Robert's included in the nine.
Yes, Robert is one of the nine.
He's an old. Ingrid is termed out. She's the one who decides to fill in the name, right? Daniel, he's here all the time.
Not today.
Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate that.
All right. June 26th. It is, I can't read that from there because I'm going blind. 422. Thank you, sir. Thank you. That's fun.
Are you doing parking validation?